WGNS, Murfreesboro.
This is FM 100.5, 101.9, AM 1450, and WGNSradio.com. Rutherford County's Place to Talk.
Hip hip hooray, let's give a cheer. It's 9 a.m., the signal's clear. Our favorite host is in the chair. The Truman Show is on the air.
It's the Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County.
The Truman Show is on the air. The Truman Show is on the air.
Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good morning, Rutherford County. It's the Greg Tucker Show today. Everybody looks forward to this particular day. Tuesday is a day that everybody, they have to turn on their radios on WGNS. Of course, most of them keep it on anyway, but this is a particular event.
Most of them keep it on anyway.
Yeah, they
That's
do.
Right. You know, flattery will get you almost anything. Truman, what do you need?
Well, you know, of course, we enjoy talking to each other and having a lot of fun even before we even get on the radio. And I was telling you about something that just really caught my eye. Yesterday I was watching the all the shows on Turner Classic Movies, what was going on in the United States before December the 7th, 1941.
And we should note that yesterday was a very important anniversary, the
yes.
74th anniversary of the worst, in my opinion, attack ever upon the United States.
Yes, by far.
By far, Pearl uh-huh. Harbor.
And up until that time, we were dealing, very similar to what's going on now, we were dealing with people who were obviously our enemies, but we were kind of dancing around and the United States, of course, is a melting pot, and there were a number of Germans and Japanese that were living and that were citizens here in the United States at the time. And I was really caught by the way that we seemed to just still dance around knowing that we have enemies here in the United States, and they had been investigating them, something like some of the terrorist things that have been going on now, but they were quietly going along, giving information back to the Japanese, and were still loyal to Japan, and something like 70,000, I believe it was the figure, 69-something, were living here in the United States, and they were having youngsters born, and as they would be born, they would go somehow swear allegiance to the one that they worshipped, which would be the initial, kind of like Hirohito was in Japan at the time. And it was in a way that Walter Houston played Uncle Sam, and one of the other older character actors was playing the guy that was trying to inform him of all the things that were going on in this country that was detrimental toward our safety as far as dealing with the foreign powers, especially Japan at the time. And I was amazed because that was done by Hollywood, and they were trying to tell us that we need to be on guard and we need to be doing something about what's happening in our country. And it really did strike a chord with me as far as how we were dealing, because it's very similar to what's going on in Washington, dealing with some of the problems that we've got now.
Well, and what you described led to what we refer collectively as the Japanese internment, when a
yes.
lot of the Japanese were gathered and essentially locked up in camps in more remote areas of the country. Every law student, I think, can go through law school in the United States, studies the legal issues around that, and applying today's point of view. Clearly, it was unconstitutional. It was illegal.
Mm-hmm.
It was in many ways inhumane. It had a lasting negative effect on a number of the families. They did fall victim, although it was not the intent, but they fell victim to loss of property, loss of business, and such as that. And I have been the last several weeks heard some of the political rhetoric being characterized as bad as or worse than the internment that we all regret at this point. I think in part what's going on is what you and I have talked about before. We are applying today's standards to circumstances in the past that we don't really know, we don't really understand. The internment was a crime, and I do think that following the war, when circumstances in the United States were different, an effort was made and should have been made to reimburse or repair the damage that was done by internment, and appropriately so. But does that mean the internment was nothing but wrong, illegal, against American standards? If we go back, and what you were describing reflects some of that, the United States has just been attacked. Our entire Pacific fleet has been either destroyed or severely handicapped. It's clear that there's an aggressor who intends to continue to treat us as an enemy. And there's information available to the president that there's possibly among the Japanese population of the United States, there are saboteurs who have plans to extend the devastation that went on Pearl Harbor. And clearly there is fear. And what's to be done? How do you react to that? Well, their decision then was, we don't know which ones. We know there are those that are perfectly innocent, but we don't know who they are, and we don't know who the dangerous ones are. So they gathered them all, or as many as they could identify. And, there also was the same concern about both Italians and Germans. And the irony of it is it was awfully hard to know who were the Italians and who were the Germans.
Yeah.
The Japanese were identifiable, and that to me is the saddest part of it, because of physical distinction.
Mm-hmm.
They were more targeted. There were internments of Italians. There were internments of Japanese, far less numerically.
Mm-hmm.
But if we go back and look at the internment, what if that action avoided one or two acts of sabotage?
Right.
How many acts of sabotage would have weighed equally against the damage done by the internment?
Mm-hmm.
That was the decision that the Roosevelt administration had to make at the time. There's a comparison historically that a lot of us overlook, and that is during the Civil War. I mean, we refer to Lincoln with some justification as one of our best presidents, standing up for freedom and human rights.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyers out there will know he suspended habeas corpus. Habeas corpus is the legal concept that means the government can't put somebody in prison or detain them without stating a reason before a judicial authority of some kind that suggests that it's a fair suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
He suspended that because, again, he didn't know who in Baltimore, Maryland, Washington, D.C. Were a risk.
Even in his own White House.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they were, a lot of them, rounded up and detained was the nice word,
mm-hmm.
In violation of habeas corpus. There were no charges brought against them. They were just held because some were concerned they were a threat. Today, if the president advised that he was suspending habeas corpus, I would hope there would be a mass outcry. But, again, circumstances at the time lead sometimes to extraordinary behavior. And comparing today to the Japanese internment is scary, because if we look at all of the circumstances, it was an acknowledgement that there are those amongst us who are going to do us harm if we don't. Our problem is we don't know who they are. I very much agree with what's being said, that to treat the Muslim, those who subscribe to Islam religion as a whole, as a that they're all alike, that's not fair.
Of course not.
But again, which ones?
Yeah.
Who? And how do we know? And how many times do we want to witness such as we've seen in France before we figure out something that we have to do? It's troubling, but to simply condemn it, not knowing what the circumstances might be, doesn't make any sense either. So it's a difficult time. But those who might compare today to the Japanese internment ought to be cautious.
Yeah.
Because if indeed the circumstances are as they were back then there may be some justification for some things. Or extol Abraham Lincoln and the way he handled everything. Be careful. Abraham Lincoln did some things that very dangerous when he gives the government the authority to arrest and detain without filing charges and explaining the reason. You know, we've got a tyranny. A tyranny defined as simply acting with, you know, beyond what the laws prescribe.
Our country always takes in consideration the rights of each individual here. And there's nothing better in this whole world than the way that this country is set up to protect people's freedoms. In some cases, it can become the way that we deal with other countries can become damaging to us, just like Cordell Hull was dealing with a couple of their envoys during that particular time, and Japan was on its way to Honolulu or to Hawaii at that time to actually try to weaken our ships in the South Pacific. And it was all done as a ruse and to cause our attention away from what was going on. And obviously, Cordell Hull made a speech after it was the bombing had occurred at Pearl Harbor. And it was the most gut-wrenching speech I have ever heard. And then, of course, President Roosevelt came on afterwards in a very angry speech that he made concerning the Japanese. And when you let your guard down, it seems like that's when the enemy is going to attack.
Well, the anger, as you describe, at the time was well justified.
Yes.
Not only had we been attacked, but we were deceived.
Yes.
And set up for it. And we were, as Americans are, trusting. Mm-hmm. And dealing with people on what was apparently their intent, then we find out different. So,
yeah.
Again, acting entirely out of anger is not to be encouraged, but realizing a real situation and trying to deal with it is what I think was going on in those early stages of World War II.
And what's happening now is not really one country against us or a couple of countries against us. We're involved in it's almost a religious war in some respects. And where do you find your enemy? I mean, it's all over the place.
And that's one of the most difficult things about today, and that is, who is the enemy?
Yeah.
Where are they?
Yeah.
Who are our allies? Can we rely on these allies? There was a good point made in, I believe, the Wall Street Journal in the last few days. All these refugees, where's Saudi Arabia? Where's the United Arab Republic, or Emirates, whatever it's called? Where's Qatar? These are Sunni populations.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are suffering the most are the Sunni Islamic group. And,
Europe and the Kurds.
Europe and the Kurds at least are in there fighting.
Yeah.
And probably our most reliable ally, but at the same time, the Turks consider them the enemy.
Yeah.
And we consider the Turks, I think. It's hard to tell as an ally. They always have been before, but, like I say, we don't know. And I'm afraid a large part of that confusion is our own fault for being, use a polite term, out of peanuts, wishy-washy about our own interest and our own intent. And so it's a mess. And
now the Russians are involved in it, which makes it even
and we gave touchier. We gave them the opening by letting them step in where we had botched everything, drawn red lines, and ignored them, whatever it was, on the chemical warfare. People are still saying that we had this false premise for invading Iraq, this business of the weapons of mass destruction, which include chemical warfare. I wonder where Syria got all that stuff. We told them we were coming.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and I hadn't seen anybody explore that yet. Yeah. But Syria had so much stuff that Russia, as much as they took charge of, there still was some left, because even after that, the Syrians, on at least two incidents thereafter, still using chemical warfare. So you wonder where they got it.
With everything so hot right now, it makes me wonder why we've pulled back on our military so much. Our spending and enforcing our military and strengthening it up is going backwards. And with all the red flags up, it shows.
Yeah, we shoot ourselves in the foot there because so often it has been the case. You can remember occasions where we look at defense spending and so much is wasted, so much is directed more to somebody's advantage economically than it is to real, So we need a very strong defense, international defense. But I wonder if we couldn't get it for less than we're paying for it, because so much seems to be wasted.
Yeah.
I can remember years ago when they started analyzing independent invoices. What was it? The $400 hammer.
Yeah.
Just ridiculous stuff.
Yeah.
And, we need another generation of this or that, in large part because the industry that produces it is idle. So we need to go on to the next generation. That's a tough call. We really need a strong defense. And Reagan demonstrated that if you apply defense money in the right way and it's apparent to the rest of the world, they back off.
Yeah.
But if you're wasting your money and your manpower, we're not gaining anything.
You know, one thing that was interesting to me when I had Admiral Jimmy Taylor on the last time was that how few people that serve in Congress now and work in Washington have ever served in the military. We have gone, it used to be years ago that most of them had spent time in the military, and now it's very low, the percentages.
During the 50s and 60s, a non-veteran didn't enter politics because we looked to the World War II veterans, and some of them exploited it beyond probably reality, such as John F. Kennedy and the stories about him. But we expected our leadership to come out of the group that knew the experience of World War II, and now that's partly because I guess we're way past that generation, but I still think we are so weak on our role in the world today.
Yeah.
And the ones we're looking to as supposedly experienced have demonstrated their inexperience or their incompetence. So it's hard to be enthusiastic. I'm going to change the subject because I want to...
Yeah, we're sounding like curmudgeons, aren't we?
Yeah. I want to pass along an accolade to our representative, Mike Sparks. Mike's a friend of mine.
Is he listening?
I don't know whether he's listening or not, but somebody else who knows him probably is. He refers to me as a blue dog, which I think is a compliment from Mike.
Blue dog? I've never heard of that one.
I'm not sure just what that means. But Mike has on several occasions organized just information sessions, mm-hmm. and he invited me last Saturday to one out at Motlow. Small group, but obviously a very interested group. We were talking about the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Mike is particularly concerned about bringing up and preserving the history of DeWitt Job, who you and I have talked about frequently, a contemporary of Sam Davis. But he asked me if I would come and talk a little bit about General Wheeler, Colonel Wheeler most of the time, mm-hmm. Who in our part of the county, or particularly the northern part of the county, was very, very active and significant during the war. And I enjoyed that opportunity because General Wheeler, I think, is one of the best sources of Civil War trivia. You know, he was born in Georgia. His family moved to New England. He was apparently outstanding as a young man in grammar school and such, mm-hmm. and he ended up getting an appointment to West Point. Mm. He was a West Point graduate, although the literature says he graduated near the bottom of the class. And when the war broke out, his allegiance apparently was more to Georgia because he immediately resigned his commission with U.S. Army and joined the Confederate forces. And one interesting trivia is there are more historic markers in Rutherford County and immediately adjacent to Rutherford County for Wheeler than there are for anybody else.
Wow.
Yeah, there's four in Rutherford County and two more just over the line in Williamson County.
Yeah.
This was it's called the Raid Around Rosecrans. He was charged with interrupting the supply lines between Nashville and Murfreesboro and did a terrific job on one raid starting in Walter Hill. He caught him at what's now Gillsville. He caught him again at what's now the Laverne City Park. He caught him again over towards Triune and then followed him on into Williamson County. Rosecrans was being starved out and finally took a whole division and sent him after Wheeler. And Wheeler just headed south for a while and avoided that. He wrote the handbook, which you can get a copy of through some of our sources of historic documents, on the Confederate cavalry maneuvers. Wow. The handbook on cavalry that was used by the Confederacy. Not Forrest. Forrest was a raider.
Yeah.
So was Morgan. Wheeler's style was to support the infantry. Mm-hmm. So when Bragg decided to retreat, Wheeler would come up and cover the rear with his cavalry. Or take a specific assignment from the infantry commander, such as cutting the supply lines. He moved south with Bragg and eventually is the one who dogged at the heels of Sherman. Hmm. I mean, we think of Sherman marching like, well, they say gone with the wind, blowing through Georgia. And that's true. There was no resistance up ahead of him. But Wheeler and his group were gnawing at his heels. All the way. And then when Jefferson Davis fled from Virginia, ending up in Georgia, again, Wheeler picked up and protected his retreat. And eventually when Davis finally surrendered, Wheeler surrendered at that time. after the war, Wheeler went back to Georgia, got elected to the state legislature, very popular in Georgia. Mm-hmm. Eventually got elected to Congress. 25 years later, he's chairing one of the major committees in Congress. And he advocates the invasion of Cuba to run the Spanish out of Cuba. Mm-hmm. He convinces his colleagues and war is declared or a mission is established to push the Spanish out of Cuba. He resigns from Congress and puts himself back in the military. He goes to Cuba as a general in the U.S. Army. Now, how many generals who commanded forces against the U.S. Army turned up as generals of the U.S. Army. He's the only one I'm aware of.
That's amazing.
And he was in charge of the division in Cuba, and I have read some reports. I'm not sure this is entirely accurate, but that there was a group within his division led by a real hothead, and they came to be known as the Rough Riders.
Mm-hmm.
And his hothead was Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And it was Wheeler who gave Roosevelt the charge or the permission to charge up San Juan Hill. And there are historians that say, they really didn't do that. But whatever they did, Teddy was able to capitalize on it and the publicity he won from that to get himself into presidential politics. So, and Wheeler, who just had a lust for combat, after Cuba, volunteered for the Philippines.
Wow.
We chased the Spanish out of Cuba, and then we went down to the Philippines. And, we also chased the Spanish out of the Philippines and occupied the Philippines for a while. We were the government of the Philippines, the United States was, for a while. And Wheeler, a question would be, what father of a later general did Wheeler serve under? The answer is Arthur MacArthur was the general who was in charge of the American forces in the Philippines, and Miller was part of his immediate entourage as a brigadier general. So Wheeler is a fascinating character. And if you'll go play golf down at Indian Hills on one of the back nine, I believe, there's the big bridge over the Middle Fork of the Stones River.
Mm-hmm.
He took that down three or four times, and they would rebuild it, and Miller would
cut. I bet the golfers really got mad, didn't they?
Yeah, mess up your game. Yeah. Wheeler would come back and burn the bridge again and knock the bridge down. And I think the last thing he did in this area was as he was pulling out, he destroyed that railroad bridge again. So he was really charged with messing up the Union supply lines.
You know, some of these people just rose above everything that was going on around them. And can you imagine the little silly things that go on in today's world? And this was right after the big war here in the United States. And he becomes extremely successful, which a lot of them did after that war. And they were accepted all across this country. And then we got these little pockets of resistance that, for whatever reason, they want to forget all the things that happened during that particular time.
Yeah. And again, it's selective use of history for whatever is your current agenda. And I hate to see it. And but someone like Wheeler, we ought not forget, because he was, in a sense, forgiving. He joined back up and became a very important part of what had been his enemy.
Yeah.
But the what he brought and what he was, who he was such that he was accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to get commissioned again as a general in the army that you fought against is rather extraordinary.
Is it? You think it might be possible, since he was a general and a leader and a politician to a degree, what if we could name the political science building over there, the Wheeler building,
where?
Well, at the university. It sits right in the middle of the city right here. We continue.
there could be those who would take exception to
that. Really?
After all, he was a Confederate general, but he was also an Army general, U.S. Army general, twice.
Yeah.
Well, no, the first time he was in the U.S. Army, of course, he didn't make general, but he was a West Point graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know exactly where he was in the class. My source just says near the bottom of the class. I wonder if Custer was beneath
him. That's what I was going to say.
I think Custer.
He ended up in Dakotas. So.
Yeah.
He wasn't near as successful, though, as Wheeler.
No, and he was not only a hothead, he was recognized as one you didn't really want under your command, because he was just liable to ignore the orders and do what he wanted. Wheeler, I think, was very much a chain of command type, because he was very popular with his seniors, like Bragg, who kept moving him up and relying on him.
You were talking this morning. Go ahead.
I started off saying I appreciate that Mike Sparks sets up programs like that. We also discussed Forrest at some length. We did talk at some length with the group about Sam Davis and DeWitt Job and D. Smith, who you know I don't hold up to high regard. Mm-hmm. And that's another one that the history has been so twisted and turned. D. Smith was basically the renegade who went AWOL from the Confederate forces and came home to avenge his cousin's death and proceeded to terrorize the civilian population mm-hmm. and eventually was brought down by one of his friends who recognized that this guy is a threat to all of us. But we had a real good conversation, and I hope in another 6 months Michael set something up like that again.
You know, the Job thing was a terrible situation because he was like Sam Davis. He was one of our runners. But the way that the North treated him, or that particular group, was almost unfathomable. I mean, you look at what they did to that man. They took torture to a different level, and it's funny that not many people really know what happened with him.
No, and you've heard my theory. In fact, I was asked about it Saturday, why we venerate and recognize Sam Davis, and justifiably so. But DeWitt Job, who did for us exactly the same, and even under the threat of death, refused to disclose his sources, mm-hmm. his friends, his mission or anything, as Sam did. But he died a horrible death compared to the formal execution of mm-hmm. Sam. The difference is what I call the Boswell factor. Samuel Johnson, a British author of, I think, the first dictionary, which was not a very good dictionary, would have been probably completely forgotten, but a fellow named James Boswell wrote a biography of him and put him into our history, our written history. Sam Davis had a Boswell, the fellow who was a Union sympathizer, but who, mm-hmm. as a favor to the family, went to recover the body and heard the firsthand stories. And then some years later, in the 1890s, wrote and published the story. Mm-hmm. And brought that story to prominence early. And DeWitt Job, the body was recovered by a slave of his family and taken back to the family home and quietly buried. And all we have in the way of records of that is correspondence amongst mm-hmm. family members, which eventually came to be known. And the story's now been written, but many, many, many years later, and without the public attention that was afforded to Sam. Mm-hmm.
See, all your research that you've done, has that changed your perception of what happened to the war during the war, during that particular time, as far as how you had been taught what happened during that particular war and what was the what was the initial causes and the results and all those things and what happened after the war as our country tried to stabilize it? Is it anything close to what you had initially thought was going on during that time as far as what you have found out during all your research?
Well, let me illustrate with one example, and we touched on this last Saturday, and let me start with a question to you, mm-hmm. which I think you answer.
Yeah.
What immediate impact did the Emancipation Proclamation have on Rutherford County?
During that time, is that what you're talking about?
The immediate impact.
Yeah.
Immediate effect.
Well, you want to get into the economic part of what happened during the Emancipation or Proclamation?
Well, there was a document.
That's what I think. That was the first thing that came into my mind.
There was a document signed on January 1, 1862.
Yeah.
What effect did that have on January 1, 2, 3, immediate in Rutherford County?
I'm going to have to ponder on this one for a while.
All right. Well, let me give you the answer. You want the answer?
Well, you give me what you think is the answer.
The answer is one word. None. Nothing.
Had no effect whatsoever.
Immediately
when it was signed.
Right. And in terms of legal effect, never.
Okay.
Never.
All right. Now explain that to me.
All right. You could lecture on the Emancipation Proclamation. And you prompt it because as we mostly remember it today and as we teach in most of our grade school history courses, this was the great document that freed a whole class of people in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You have to first back up to September 1862. In September 1862, Lincoln was persuaded that the slave population in the South was continuing to produce food and fiber used for clothing mm-hmm. that supported the Confederate forces.
Mm-hmm.
And that a great deal of effect could be had on the ability of the rebels, as they were called, to continue the fight if they no longer had that kind of support.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln was very cautious at that point, and rather than act immediately, he issued the pre-proclamation. I had never heard of the pre-proclamation until I began doing research. Mm-hmm. The pre-proclamation, it's online if somebody wants to pull it up, said in effect that I'm going to give you, the rebels, 100 days to lay down your arms and to end the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, I'm not going to do anything else to you. Okay, mm-hmm. Now back off and think about that just a minute. His next thing was, now, if you don't, I'm going to free your slaves.
Hmm.
Okay, so in September 1862, he told the parts of the South that were under rebellion that if you'll lay down your arms, I will leave you with your slaves.
What were there any other conditions that went along with that?
Had to lay down your arms.
That was it.
That was it. And submit to the United States jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But if you don't, I'm going to free the slaves. All right. He went on to make clear that first thing he would do was to specify those areas, according to the military information he had been given, that were still under rebellion.
Hmm.
And his order would apply only to those. Now, let's go behind his thinking a little bit. He was very specifically saying, if you lay down your arms, we'll keep the slaves and keep them working, i.e. we will transfer their product, mm-hmm. food, fiber, whatever it may be, from support for the Confederate forces to support for the Union forces. You follow me?
I'm following you.
All right. In other words, we're going to leave them there working on the plantation or wherever if you will lay down your arms. And then, of course,
under the same
us.
Economic conditions?
He said they will stay. I will free them only if you fail to lay down your arms.
Yeah.
All right. Now, legally, did he have the authority to do that? No. And he admits that in his papers, the documents themselves, he cites his war authority and avoids any mm-hmm. reference to the Constitution, because constitutionally he didn't have that authority.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, how do you do anything in an area that you don't control? You don't have jurisdiction over, because mm-hmm. obviously the parts of the South that were in rebellion,
right.
He wasn't the government there as far as they were concerned. He wouldn't be able to enforce anything that he did, but that's what he said he was going to do. The 100 days passes, brings us to January 1, 1863, and nobody has taken up his offer.
Can you explain? His offer is fascinating.
His offer
what was the end that he was end result that he was looking for.
He was trying to weaken the military resistance of the Confederacy.
Yeah.
By taking away the economic ability to produce food, produce fiber, and supply the Confederate forces.
Mm-hmm.
This is in the papers.
Yeah.
All right. And he was persuaded by his military that this would have the result. And also they were aware that a lot of the slave population were doing what would you saw, the driving the wagons and working behind the...
Well, that is pretty. I haven't heard that song before.
Yeah, you're not going to hear it again either. I turned it off. Okay, on January 1, 1863, he signs the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mm.
The first part of it says this does not this applies only to these areas.
Mm-hmm.
And he names the areas it's going to apply to. First, he goes back and recites his pre-proclamation and then says that this will apply only to Arkansas, Texas, certain parts of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and certain parts of Virginia. You didn't hear Tennessee, did you?
I didn't hear Tennessee at all.
The Emancipation Proclamation, by its express terms, did not apply to Tennessee. The reason was that he took the position, his military did, that Tennessee is under Union control. They are no longer in rebellion. We have subdued Tennessee, and they are now no longer a threat. So he omitted Tennessee completely.
Let's take a quick break.
All right.
And get back to this. All right, we'll be right back with you.
Northside Healthcare.
We're committed to compassionate, high quality, and collaborative medical care that is delivered by a team of nurses, assistants, therapists, dietitians, and other supportive caregivers.
They need me, and I suppose I need them too. They make me happy, and I make them happy. It makes you feel great. You are a part of that. To get them up and motivated and getting them feeling better.
Get well, live well at Northside Healthcare on East MTCS Drive beside Middle Tennessee Christian School.
News Radio WGNS, Murfreesboro.
It could be any moment the deer of a lifetime walks by, and you have to be prepared. That's why you need to shop Murfreesboro Outdoors.
This is Randy at Murfreesboro Outdoors.
All right, now you hit that one, my boy.
We got camouflage clothes, shotguns, shells, boots, pretty much anything. We got it. If we don't have it, we'll get it.
Murfreesboro Outdoors on Northwest Broad Street, just down from the old International Paper location.
Cut projects on your to-do list? Now, during Kubota's Power to Do Great Things sales event, get a great deal on a tractor you'll be proud to own. A Kubota L2501 with a powerful diesel engine and choice of transmission. Now get financing as low as 0% APR for up to 5 years and great customer instant rebates when you buy a new L2501 and two implements. Now through December 31st, 2015. Call toll-free 1-888-465-8268 for details about cost and terms.
Visit Murfreesboro Kubota on Broad Street next to Harley. Online at MurfreesboroKubota.com.
The city of Murfreesboro welcomes a brand new open concept 9,000 square foot event center. This event venue offers a grand banquet space with 20-foot high ceilings, an elegant cocktail area, fully equipped prep kitchen, inbuilt sound and lighting system, as well as changing rooms. Occasions Event Center is suited to host a variety of events, including both wedding and reception under one roof, even corporate events and trade shows. Visit atoccasions.com. That's atoccasions.com.
Providing Christmas for those who won't have one. I'm Ron Jordan, News Radio WGNS. Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue and the Toys for Tots program is celebrating their 32nd year of helping Murfreesboro families with gifts for children. Assistant Fire Marshal Michael Bartlett told News Radio WGNS there's still time to sign up your kids to get gifts.
We need to get a lot more people to sign up. We have registration that's going to be going on Tuesday the 8th, Wednesday the 9th, and Thursday the 10th of December. The time will be between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock. And it will be at First Cumberland Presbyterian Church on 907 East Main Street.
Right now, only about 300 children have signed up to get gifts, but Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue has room for up to 1,000 children. This Saturday, December 13th, from noon to 8, the Holly Trolley Shopping Tour will be traveling through the downtown area again. Main Street Murfreesboro hosts the event again this year. The shopping tour of the downtown area will offer free trolley rides running from Oakland's Mansion on Maney to and around the square. There's no need to make reservations, just park anywhere you can and ride the trolley. The horrendous traffic tie-ups on I-24 due to an overturned semi Monday reportedly caused by two men drag racing. Police say 30-year-old Jason Bogard and 25-year-old Brandon Lenore caused the crash around 12:45 p.m. Bogard and Lenore face charges of drag racing, driving on a suspended license, and reckless endangerment. They're both being held at the Rutherford County Adult Detention Center. Bogard's bond is $6,500, and Lenore's bond, $8,500. That's the news you need to know. I'm Ron Jordan, News Radio WGNS.
Brought to you by
Ace Construction of Tennessee.
Ace Construction is properly licensed, insured, and bonded for your protection.
Kenny Bell with AceConstructionTN.com.
Let Jeff prepare your turkey and fixings for the holiday activities. Turkeys are deep fried, smoked, or baked, along with Nana's cakes and pies, cobblers, and made in-house. Complete meals are prepared by the Sowell brothers and the staff. Catering orders accepted for office parties. Party space available. Phone 867-2164 to place orders. Located at 467 Hancock Street, two blocks off of East Main. Home of the full air cakes and the best real homemade banana pudding in Peach Cobbler, Tennessee. Come to see for yourself. We're open from 11 to 6 on Monday through Saturday and 11 to 5 on Sunday. Tell Jeff and Jim Papa Sowell sent you.
Murfreesboro Rotary's Pancake Breakfast at Middle Tennessee Christian School has been a tradition for 13 years.
Hot Cakes and Holly is this Saturday morning from 7 to 10:30 at Middle Tennessee Christian School.
Rotary's Pancake Breakfast is bigger than ever.
We're in the old gym.
Youngsters can enjoy a breakfast with Santa.
Live music.
Tickets are available at the door.
And it supports the many services of Murfreesboro Rotary that help our community.
Hot Cakes and Holly is 7 to 10:30 this Saturday morning
at Middle Tennessee Christian School.
Weather-wise.
Mostly sunny skies this afternoon, a high in the lower 60s and southwest winds of 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear and a low near 41. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki on News Radio WGNS. Right now, 36.
The Beasley Foundation oversees three programs in Rutherford County that serve animals daily. They operate the Affordable Spay and Neuter Clinic, and they educate the public on promoting responsible pet care, and they also offer financial assistance for spaying or neutering cats and dogs. Learn more at BeasleyAnimalClinic.com.
The Truman Show on News Radio WGNS, FM 100.5, FM 101.9, AM 1450, online and on your phone at WGNSradio.com.
Welcome back with Greg Tucker. He's throwing me all these curves around here.
I had a great blank look going. I wish we had been on video for that right then. So who freed the slaves in Rutherford County and how?
It was in 19.
No.
Okay. Wait a minute. We're talking about really did or
1865. 1865, the Tennessee legislature, obviously at that time controlled by the radical right of Lincoln's party, voted by state law to end slavery in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Did it?
As a legal matter, probably yes. In fact, probably not. It took the end of the war.
Yeah.
Officially, there was a vote of the state legislature. Now, was that vote in action constitutional? That would raise a question, and you could argue it because U.S. Grant said that the runaways that were coming to him when he came through here with his army heading down to Shiloh, you know what he labeled them? He says these are contraband. In other words, he was recognizing property rights, something that's obviously repulsive today, but back then it was property, and one back then could have made the argument that you can't take property away from somebody without just compensation. That's in the Constitution. So whether or not the Tennessee Act would have stood up if there had been a system like today is a question, but a legal system. But the legislature, the state legislature, knowing that the Emancipation Proclamation by its terms did not apply to Tennessee, when it was clear how the war was going to end up in early 1865, voted to free the slaves in Tennessee. The slaves in those states that were still in rebellion by the terms of the Emancipation Proclamation became free as soon as the United States took over jurisdiction, mm-hmm. which was the surrender of the Confederacy in April 1865. So legally, if he had any authority at all, it didn't happen until the war ended. But as I said, Tennessee was not affected by the Emancipation Proclamation. And before the end of the war, the state legislature voted in the end of slavery. The ultimate end of slavery in the United States was the 13th Amendment, mm-hmm. because that obviously got past all the constitutional arguments about whether it was procedurally done correctly or legally or what have you. And it's proper to celebrate the 13th Amendment in that manner, I think. I would be interested in others' opinions of the Emancipation Proclamation if they would take time to actually read it, read the text of it, and read the pre-proclamation. It's clear, as Barbara Markle told us briefly when she was here, that it was a military tactic. It was an attempt to give advantage to the U.S. Army and to disadvantage the Confederate forces by denying them tactical, logistical support, the food, the fiber, and such mm-hmm. that was being produced by the slave population at the time.
The people that want to make all their judgments right now, if they could put themselves back 150-something years into what was going on at that time, it would be amazed. They would be amazed at some of the tactics that were happening that have made us the way we are today. And they want to put themselves in that condition right now after everything has changed for all these years, and they don't really have a clue of how it got here.
It doesn't work.
No.
I believe we were off the air when you asked why would Lincoln leave out Tennessee?
Yeah.
Well, the exclamation on the face of the document was that Tennessee was no longer in rebellion. But after the proclamation, the proclamation was signed while the Battle of Stones River was still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously long before the Battle of Lookout Mountain, and there was a whole lot of skirmishing in between. So I would conclude that it was partly the Army was already enjoying the support of the productive farm activity in those areas that were under the control of the U.S. Army. Perhaps in some cases they were buying the products, but in most cases they were confiscating it as it was produced. But remember also that a substantial part of Tennessee never agreed to secession. Mm-hmm. We were the last out, first back in, largely because there was a large unionist, they called them, in East Tennessee, mm-hmm. and even in Murfreesboro. You know, you could make a list of those who were leaning towards the Union from the outset for personal reasons, mostly economic reasons. Mm-hmm. So politically, it was probably smart of Lincoln to leave out Tennessee and not aggravate the circumstances that were at the time leaning and favoring towards the Union, and one of which was the fact that the farms still in production, the plantations still in production, mostly were ending up as Union supply lines in Tennessee. So why disturb that by freeing the workers, assuming that if they were freed, they would quit working? So
it was strictly a military decision, right?
It was. Yeah, intended to impact the resources of the two sides,
mm-hmm.
primarily to deny the Confederate forces the material they needed, and essentially to transfer it if it went into areas under Union control. It would transfer it because you know that the production of Middle Tennessee, Rutherford County, after January 1863 went all to the advantage of the Unions. The reason we had Wheeler up there trying to shut down the supply lines
mm-hmm.
because it was coming down through Nashville and other parts of the mid-state.
We make a mistake a bad mistake when we try to put ourselves in those type situations and make it according to today's rules, don't we? It's not looking. It's not being very fair.
It's not
when you're rating those type people.
Yeah, it's not fair to the legacy of those of that time. I think it is, though, productive to the extent it can be done to study, our primary sources, and to understand what the circumstances were, and then we can draw some conclusions and judgments that are more of a fair nature, and then I think we find things that we can use in today's world, today's society, and understand. If we would fully understand what was going on before World War II, after we were attacked, and with the information that was available that was threatening internally, we might react a little more logically to our circumstances today.
Now, speaking of logic, when is the next Forest Hall meeting, ROTC Forest Hall?
I don't know a date, but it'll be in town. And talking to the chairman, he wants to hold the next public forum in the courthouse.
Great.
And I hope that can be worked out.
Yeah.
Access will be a lot better for the community people.
Yeah.
I think there's a backup location, but I'm hoping that the courthouse will work out. It'll be after Christmas, after the holidays, I assume, after classes resume on the campus. And I encourage those who have an opinion or want to be heard to say so. If we've got a few minutes, I want to shout out to a couple of people, too. Herschel Whitlock, thank you. Thank you also to Charlie Woods, Charles Kilgore, Matthew Page, Steve Murphy, Rob Mitchell, our property assessor, Mike Sparks, one of our state representatives, Jack Wilson, a retired military who raised the issues of diversity, Lou Ferrara, a retired brigadier general who raised issues of this business of offending someone, Monty House, and James Stallings. These people stepped forward in a very difficult environment on the campus and spoke on behalf of the legacy of Nathan Bedford Forrest and the history of the ROTC and the relationships with the community. I highlighted Wilson and Ferrara in particular because what I came away from understanding, unfortunately, is that when some people say diversity, they don't mean what I think diversity means. Diversity means a whole variety and blend of different cultures, different attitudes, different genders, different races, different nationalities, diversity, and a tolerance for the differences. I heard people saying diversity, and it was clear they said, what I want is diversity.
Yeah.
What I am or who I am, diversity is just what I want, just what I'm comfortable with. Jack Wilson, who I think is an ROTC alum, he made clear that diversity means tolerance.
Yeah.
It means giving others an opportunity, an equal opportunity to have their views, to have their attitudes. General Ferrara talked about offense and noted that those who claim the right not to be offended don't seem to hesitate a minute to offend others and to be offensive in their manner. I have never been in a public forum sponsored by a university where I heard so much profanity and shouting. I mean, I learned long ago that if you've got a good argument, a good point you want to make, and you have to shout or swear excessively to make your point, you have a very weak argument. You have a very weak point. And that's what I heard, and that's what I saw. And particularly unfortunate, there was a adjunct faculty member who was a woman, the most profane.
You gotta be kidding me.
No. She's an adjunct professor in the Afro-American Studies Department. And She not only was very profane in her characterization of the comments made by others, she urged the students to continue their behavior. And I'm thankful for the circumstances, because there are many countries around the world where speaking as she did and encouraging activity by others against the authority probably would have led to an arrest. And
what a terrible representative for our group.
Fortunately, we live in a country where you can get up and be profane if you are determined to offend. And, you know, I'd heard all the words before, but never in a context like that.
Yeah.
And I know that even some that sympathized with the point of view that was being expressed cringed.
Mm-hmm.
And I do hope that the chairman will be more aggressive in the next meeting to keep things, particularly if it's in the Rutherford County Courthouse, on a level of exchange of information and opinion, and not an attempt to offend in that way.
You know, right here is kind of just a microcosm of what's going on in this country. Of course, at a lesser level, but it's a shame that they're attacking the rights and the freedoms and especially our safety in this country. I mean, I've seen what's going on in law enforcement and in so many different venues, and it really does sicken me, because the one group that has kept us strong and healthy all of these years has been our law enforcement, and now they seem to be the biggest target, and anytime they make a move, and what's so odd about it is one of the major cities was upset because the law enforcement officers were not going back into those areas again and keeping things safe for them, and they're the ones that are trying to run them out. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, for a little bit of light in the midst of things, it's interesting that those who are complaining so bitterly about the way things are in this country are using the freedoms that we mm-hmm. enjoy, and enjoying those freedoms and their ability to make those complaints.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of ironic.
Yeah. Great show. I'm a little angry now, but I'll get over it the time I get outside in the fresh air, and I'll change my attitude.
I'm always asking you questions you can't answer.
Don't I know. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's nothing like being a foil. Am I Lou Costello or what?
I got to have a straight man.
I know. All right, guys. We'll see you in the morning at 9 o'clock, and enjoy your day.
Thank you, Tim.